Be the boss of the frost this winter with BetMGM Casino. Get out of the cold with more than 500 dazzling slots and exciting table games that have red-hot action. Play traditional games like roulette and blackjack with live dealers. Grin when you spin on spectacular slot favorites like Cash Eruption, 88 Fortune, Mystery of the Lamp, Rack and Bacon, Cash Machine, Flintstones, and Squid Game from anywhere. If you're in front of a roaring fire at the ski lodge, in a crowded airport on a layover, or just relaxing at home in your comfy living room chair, BetMGM Casino puts gaming fun in the palm of your hand. So, whether you're taking a shot at a jackpot up to $1 million, doubling down at the blackjack table, or deciding between red and black, make BetMGM your go-to app. BetMGM.com for terms. 21 years of age or older to wager. Michigan, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia only. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Chapter 24 of Stepping Heavenward. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Teresa Downey. Stepping Heavenward by Elizabeth Prentice. Chapter 24. March 20th. Helen returned Dr. Cabot's letter in silence this morning, but directly after breakfast set forth to visit Mrs. Campbell with a little bottle of beef tea in her hands, which ought to have gone yesterday. I had a busy day before me, the usual Saturday baking and Sunday dinner to oversee, the children's lessons for tomorrow to superintend and hear them repeat, their clean clothes to lay out, and a basket of stockings to mend. My mind was somewhat distracted with these cares, and I found it a little difficult to keep on with my morning devotions in spite of them. But I have learned, at least, to face and fight such distractions instead of running away from them as I used to do. My faith in prayer, my resort to it, becomes more and more the foundation of my life, and I believe, with one wiser and better than myself, that nothing but prayer stands between my soul and the best gifts of God. In other words, that I can and shall get what I ask for. I went down into the kitchen, put on my large baking apron, and began my labors. Of course, the doorbell rang, and a poor woman was announced. It is very sweet to follow Fenelon's counsel and give oneself to Christ in all these interruptions, but this time I said, "Oh, dear," before I thought. Then I wished I hadn't, and went up, with a cheerful face at any rate, to my unwelcome visitor, who proved to be one of my aggravating poor folks, a great giant of a woman, in perfect health, and with a husband to support her if he will. I told her that I could do no more for her. She answered me rudely, and kept urging her claims. I felt ruffled. Why should my time be thus frittered away, I asked myself. At last she went off, abusing me in a way that chilled my heart. I could only beg God to forgive her, and return to my work, which I had hardly resumed when Mrs. Embury sent for a pattern that I had promised to lend her. Off came my apron, and up two pairs of stairs I ran. After a long search, it came to light. Work resumed, doorbell again. Auntie wanted the children to come to an early dinner. Going to Auntie's is next to going to paradise to them. Everything was now hurry and flurry. I tried to be patient, and not to fret their temper by undue attention to nails, ears, and other susceptible parts of the human frame. But after it was all over, and I had kissed all the sweet dear faces goodbye, and returned to the kitchen, I felt sure that I had not been the perfect mother I want to be in all these little emergencies. Yes, far from it. Bridget had let the milk I was going to use boil over, and finally burn up. I was annoyed and irritated, and already tired, and did not see how I was to get more, as Mary was cleaning the silver. To be sure, there is not much of it, and had other extra Saturday work to do. I thought Bridget might offer to run to the corner for it, though it isn't her business. But she is not obliging, and seemed as sulky as if I had burned the milk, not she. After all, I said to myself, What does it signify if Ernest gets no dessert? It isn't good for him, and how much precious time is wasted over just this one thing? However, I reflected, that arbitrarily refusing to indulge him in this respect is not exactly my mission as his wife. He is perfectly well and likes his little luxuries as well as other people do. So I humbled my pride and asked Bridget to go for the milk, which she did in a lofty way of her own. While she was gone, the marketing came home, and I had everything to dispose of. Ernest had sent home some apples, which plainly said, "I want some apple pie, Katie." I looked nervously at the clock and undertook to gratify him. Mary came down, crying, to say that her mother, who lived in Brooklyn, was very sick. Could she go see her? I looked at the clock once more, told her she should go, of course, as soon as lunch was over. This involved my doing all her absence left undone. At last I got through with the kitchen, the Sunday dinner being well under way, and ran upstairs to put away the host of little garments the children had left when they took their flight, and to make myself presentable at lunch. Then I began to be uneasy lest Ernest should not be punctual, and Mary be delayed. But he came just as the clock struck one. I ran joyfully to meet him, very glad now that I had something good to give him. We had just got through lunch, and I was opening my mouth to tell Mary she might go, when the doorbell rang once more, and Mrs. Fry of Jersey City was announced. I told Mary to wait till I found whether she had lunched or not. No, she hadn't. Had come to town to see her friends off, was half famished, and would I do her the favor, etc., etc. She had a fashionable young lady with her, a stranger to me, as well as a Miss Somebody Else from Albany, whose name I did not catch. I apologized for having finished lunch. Mrs. Fry said all they wanted was a cup of tea and a bit of bread and butter. Nothing else, dear. Now don't put yourself out. "Now be bright and animated and like yourself," she whispered. "For I have brought these girls here on purpose to hear you talk, and they are prepared to fall in love with you on the spot." This speech sufficed to shut my mouth. Mary had to get ready for these unexpected guests, whose appetites proved equal to a raid on a good many things besides bread and butter. Mrs. Fry said, after she had devoured nearly half a loaf of cake, that she would really try to eat a morsel more, which Ernest remarked dryly was a great triumph of mind over matter. As they talked and laughed and ate leisurely on, Mary stood looking the picture of despair. At last I gave her a glance that said she might go, when a new visitor was announced, Mrs. Winthrop from Brooklyn, one of Ernest's patients a few years ago, when she lived here. She professed herself greatly indebted to him, and said she had come at this hour because she should make sure of seeing him. I tried to excuse him, as I knew he would be thankful to have me do, but no, see him she must. He was her, quote, pet doctor, unquote. He had such a sweet bedside manner, and I am such a favorite with him, you know. Ernest did not receive his favorite with any special warmth, but invited her out to lunch and gallanted her to the table we had just left. Just like a man. Poor Mary! She had to fly around and get up what she could. Mrs. Winthrop devoted herself to Ernest with a persistent ignoring of me that I thought rude and unwomanly. She asked if he had read a certain book. He had not. She then said, quote, "I need not ask, then, if Mrs. Elliot has done so. These charming dishes, which she gets up so nicely, must absorb all her time," unquote. "Of course," replied Ernest. "But she contrives to read the reports of all the murders, of which the newspapers are full." Mrs. Winthrop took this speech literally, drew her skirts from me, looked at me through her eyeglass, and said, "Yes?" At last she departed. Helen came home, and Mary went. I gave Helen an account of my morning. She laughed heartily, and it did me good to hear that musical sound once more. "It is nearly 5 o'clock," I said, as we at last had restored everything to order, "and this whole day has been frittered away in the veriest trifles. It isn't living to live so. Who is the better for my being in the world since 6 o'clock this morning?" "I am, for one," she said, kissing my hot cheeks, "and you have given a great deal of pleasure to several persons. Your and Ernest's hospitality is always graceful. I admire it in you both. And this is one of the little ways, not to be despised, of giving enjoyment." It was nice of her to say that. It quite rested me. At the dinner table, Ernest complimented me on my good housekeeping. "I was very proud of my little wife at lunch," he said. "And yet you said that outrageous thing about my reading about nothing but murders," I said.
"Oh, well, you understood it," he said laughingly.
"But that dreadful Mrs. Winthrop took it literally."
"What do we care for Mrs. Winthrop?" he returned. "If you could have seen the contrast between you two in my eyes. After all, one must take life as it comes. Its homely details are so mixed up with its sweet charities and loves and friendships that one is forced to believe that God has joined them together and does not will that they should be put asunder. It is something that my husband has been satisfied with his wife and his home today. That does me good." March 30th. A stormy day, and the children home from school, and no little frolicking and laughter going on. It must be delightful to feel well and strong while one's children are young. There is so much to do for them. I do it, but no one can tell the effort it costs me. What a contrast there is between their vitality and the languor under which I suffer. When their noise became intolerable, I proposed to read to them, and of course they made 10 times as much clamor of pleasure, and of course they leaned on me and ground their elbows into my lap and tired me all out. As I sat with this precious little group about me, Ernest opened the door, looked in gravely and without a word, and instantly disappeared. I felt uneasy and asked him this evening why he looked so. Was I indulging the children too much, or what was it? He took me into his arms and said, "My precious wife, why will you torment yourself with such fancies? My very heart was yearning over you at that moment, as it did the first time I saw you surrounded by your little class at Sunday school, years ago, and I was asking myself why God has given me such a wife and my children such a mother."
Oh, I am glad I have got this written down. I will read it over when the sense of my deficiencies overwhelms me, while I ask God why He has given me such a patient, forbearing husband. April 1st. This has been a sad day to our church. Our dear Dr. Cabot has gone to his eternal home and left us as sheep without a shepherd. His death was sudden at the last and found us all unprepared for it. But my tears of sorrow are mingled with tears of joy. His heart had been long in heaven, and he was ready to go at a moment's warning. Never was a soul so constantly and joyously on the wing as his. Poor Mrs. Cabot. She is left very desolate, for all their children are married and settled at a distance. But she bears this sorrow like one who has long felt herself a pilgrim and a stranger on earth. How strange that we ever forget that we are all such. April 16th. The desolate pilgrimage was not long. Dear Mrs. Cabot was this day laid away by the side of her beloved husband, and it is delightful to think of them as not divided by death, but united by it, in a complete and eternal union. I never saw a husband and wife more tenderly attached to each other, and this is a beautiful close to their long and happy married life. I find it hard not to wish and pray that I may as speedily follow my precious husband, should God call him away first. But it is not for me to choose. How I shall miss these faithful friends, who, from my youth up, have been my stay and my staff in the house of my pilgrimage. Almost all the disappointments and sorrows of my life have had their Christian sympathy, particularly the daily, wasting solicitude concerning my darling Una, for they, too, watched for years over as delicate a flower and saw it fade and die. Only those who have suffered thus can appreciate the heart soreness through which, no matter how outwardly cheerful I may be, I am always passing. But what, then? Have I not 10,000 times made this my prayer, that in the words of Leighton, my will might become identical with God's will? And shall He not take me at my word? Just as I was writing these words, my canary burst forth with a song so joyous that a song was also put into my mouth. Something seemed to say, "This captive sings in his cage because it has never known liberty and cannot regret a lost freedom." So the soul of my child, limited by the restrictions of a feeble body, never have known the gladness of exuberant health, may sing songs that will enliven and cheer. Yes, and does sing them. What should we do without her gentle, loving presence, whose frailty calls forth our tenderest affections, and whose sweet face makes sunshine in the shadiest places?
I am sure that the boys are truly blessed by having a sister always at home to welcome them, and that their best manliness is appealed to by her helplessness. What this child is to me, I cannot tell. And yet, if the skillful and kind gardener should house this delicate plant before frosts come, should I dare to complain? End of chapter 24. Recording by Teresa Downey. Chapter 25 of Stepping Heavenward. This is the LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Teresa Downey. Stepping Heavenward by Elizabeth Prentice. Chapter 25. May 4th. Miss Clifford came to lunch with us on Wednesday. Her remarkable restoration to health has attracted a great deal of attention, and has given Ernest a certain reputation which does not come amiss to him. Not that he is ambitious, a more unworldly man does not live, but his extreme reserve and modesty have obscured the light that is now beginning to shine. We all enjoyed Miss Clifford's visit. She is one of the freshest, most original creatures I ever met with, and kept us all laughing with her quaint speeches, long after every particle of lunch had disappeared from the table. But this mobile nature turns to the serious side of life with marvelous ease and celerity, as perhaps all sound ones ought to do. I took her up to my room where my workbasket was, and Helen followed with hers. "I have brought something to read to you, dear Mrs. Elliot," Miss Clifford began, the moment we had seated ourselves, "which I have just lighted on, and I am sure you will like. A nobleman writes to Fenelon, asking certain questions, and a part of these questions, with the replies, I want to enjoy with you, as they cover a good deal of the ground we have often discussed together. 1. How shall I offer my purely indifferent actions to God? Walks, visits made and received, dress, little proprieties, such as washing the hands, etc., the reading of books of history, business with which I am charged for my friends, other amusements, such as shopping, having clothes made, and equipages. I want to have some sort of prayer or method of offering each of these things to God. Reply. The most indifferent actions cease to be such, and become good as soon as one performs them with the intention of conforming oneself in them to the will of God. They are often better and purer than certain actions which appear more virtuous. First, because they are less of our own choice and more in the order of providence when one is obliged to perform them. Second, because they are simpler and less exposed to vain complacence. Third, because if one yields to them with moderation, one finds in them more of death to one's inclinations than in certain acts of fervor in which self-love mingles. Finally, because these little occasions occur more frequently, and furnish a secret occasion for continually making every moment profitable. It is not necessary to make great efforts, nor acts of great reflection, in order to offer what are called indifferent actions. It is enough to lift the soul one instant to God, to make a simple offering of it. Everything which God wishes us to do, and which enters into the course of occupation suitable to our position, can and ought to be offered to God. Nothing is unworthy of him but sin. When you feel that an action cannot be offered to God, conclude that it does not become a Christian. It is at least necessary to suspect it, and seek light concerning it. I would not have a special prayer for each of these. The elevation of the heart at the moment suffices. As for visits, commissions, and the like, as there is danger of following one's own taste too much, I would add to this elevating of the heart a prayer to moderate myself and use precaution. 2. In prayer I cannot fix my mind, or I have intervals of time when it is elsewhere, and it is often distracted for a long time before I perceive it. I want to find some means of becoming its master. Reply. Fidelity in following the rules that have been given you, and in recalling your mind every time you perceive its distraction, will gradually give you the grace of being more recollected. Meanwhile, Bear your involuntary distractions with patience and humility. You deserve nothing better. Is it surprising that recollection is difficult to a man so long dissipated and far from God? 3. I wish to know if it is best to record on my tablets the faults and the sins I have committed in order not to run the risk of forgetting them. I excite myself to repentance for my faults as much as I can, but I have never felt any real grief on account of them. When I examine myself at night, I see persons far more perfect than I complain of more sin. As for me, I seek, I find nothing, and yet it is impossible there should not be many points on which to implore pardon every day of my life. Reply: You should examine yourself every night, but simply and briefly. In the disposition to which God has brought you, you will not voluntarily commit any considerable fault without remembering and reproaching yourself for it. As to little faults, scarcely perceived, even if you sometimes forget them, this need not make you uneasy. As to a lively grief on account of your sins, it is not necessary. God gives it when it pleases Him. True and essential conversion of the heart consists in a full will to sacrifice all to God. What I call full will is a fixed, immovable disposition of the will, to resume none of the voluntary affections which may alter the purity of the love to God, and abandon itself to all the crosses to which it will, perhaps, be necessary to bear, in order to accomplish the will of God, always and in all things. As to sorrow for sin, when one has it, one ought to return thanks for it. When one perceives it to be wanting, one should humble oneself peacefully before God, without trying to excite it by vain efforts. You find in your self-examination fewer faults than persons more advanced and more perfect do. It is because your interior light is still feeble. It will increase, and the view of your infidelities will increase in proportion. It suffices, without making yourself uneasy, to try to be faithful to the degree of light you possess, and to instruct yourself by reading and meditation. It will not do to try to forestall the grace that belongs to a more advanced period. It would only serve to trouble and discourage you, and even to exhaust you by continual anxiety. The time that should be spent in loving God would be given to forced returns upon yourself, which secretly nourish self-love. 4. In my prayers, my mind has difficulty in finding anything to say to God. My heart is not in it, or it is inaccessible to the thoughts of my mind. Reply: It is not necessary to say much to God. Oftentimes one does not speak much to a friend whom one is delighted to see. One looks at him with pleasure, one speaks certain short words to him which are mere expressions of feeling. The mind has no part in them, or next to none. One keeps repeating the same words. It is not so much a variety of thoughts that one seeks in intercourse with a friend, as a certain repose and correspondence of heart. It is thus we are with God, who does not disdain to be our tenderest, most cordial, most familiar, most intimate friend. A word, a sigh, a sentiment says all to God. It is not always necessary to have transports of sensible tenderness, a will all naked and dry, without life, without vivacity, without pleasure, is often purest in the sight of God. In fine, it is necessary to content oneself with giving to Him what He gives it to give. A fervent heart when it is fervent, a heart firm and faithful in its aridity, when He deprives it of sensible fervor. It does not always depend on you to feel, but it is necessary to wish to feel. Leave it to God to choose to make you to feel sometimes, in order to sustain your weakness and infancy in Christian life, sometimes weaning you from that sweet and consoling sentiment which is the milk of babes, in order to humble you, to make you grow, and to make you robust in the violent exercise of faith, by causing you to sweat the bread of the strong in the sweat of your brow. Would you only love God according as He will make you take pleasure in loving Him? You would be loving your own tenderness and feeling, fancying that you were loving God. Even while receiving sensible gifts, prepare yourself by pure faith for the time when you might be deprived of them, and you will suddenly succumb if you had only relied on such support. Oh, I forgot to speak of some practices which may, at the beginning, facilitate the remembrance of the offering one ought to make to God of all the ordinary acts of the day. 1. Form the resolution to do so every morning, and call yourself to account in your self-examination at night. 2. Make no resolutions but for good reasons, either from propriety or the necessity of relaxing the mind, etc. Thus, in accustoming oneself to retrench the useless, little by little, one accustoms oneself to offer what is not proper to curtail. 3. Renew oneself in this disposition whenever one is alone, in order to be better prepared to recollect it when in company. 4. Whenever one surprises oneself in too great dissipation, or in speaking too freely of his neighbor, let him collect himself and offer to God all the rest of the conversation. 5. To flee with confidence to God, to act according to His will, when one enters company or engages in some occupation which may cause one to fall into temptation. The sight of danger ought to warn of the need there is to lift the heart toward Him by one who may be preserved from it. We both thanked her as she finished reading, and I begged her to lend me the volume that I might make the above copy. I hope I have gained some valuable hints from this letter, and that I shall see more plainly than ever that it is a religion of principle that God wants from us, not one of mere feeling. Helen remarked that she was most struck by the assertion that one cannot forestall the graces that belong to a more advanced period. She said she had assumed that she ought to experience all that the most mature Christian did, and that it rested her to think of God as doing this work for her, making repentance, for instance, a free gift, not a conquest to be won for oneself. Miss Clifford said that the whole idea of giving oneself to God in such little daily acts as visiting, shopping, and the like, was entirely new to her. "But fancy," she went on, her beautiful face lighted up with enthusiasm, "what a blessed life that must be, when the base things of this world, and things that are despised, are so many links to the invisible world and to the things God has chosen." "In other words," I said, "the top of the ladder that rests on earth reaches to heaven, and we may ascend it as the angels did in Jacob's dream." "And descend, too, as they did," Helen put in despondently. "Now you shall not speak in that tone," cried Miss Clifford. "Let us look at the bright side of life, and believe that God means us to be always ascending, always getting nearer to Himself, always learning something new about Him, always loving Him better and better. To be sure, our souls are sick, and of themselves can't keep ever on the wing. But I have had some delightful thoughts of late from just hearing the title of a book, God's Method with the Maladies of the Soul. It gives one such a conception of the seeming ills of life, to think of Him as our physician, the ills all remedies, the deprivations only a wholesome regimen, the losses all gains. Why, as I study this individual case and that, see how patiently and persistently he tries now this remedy, now that, and how infallibly he cures the souls that submit to his remedies. I love him so, and I am so astonished that we are restive under his unerring hand. To think how he dealt with me. My soul was sick unto death, sick with worldliness and self-pleasing and folly. There was only one way of making me listen to reason, and that was just the way he took. He snatched me right out of the world and shut me up in one room, crippled, helpless, and alone, and set me to thinking, 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 till I saw the emptiness and the shallowness of all in which I had hitherto been involved. And then he sent you and your mother to show me the reality of life and to reveal to me my invisible, unknown physician. Can I love him with half my heart? Can I be asking questions as to how much I am to pay towards the debt I owe him?" By this time, Helen's work had fallen from her hands, and tears were in her eyes. "How I thank you," she said softly, "for what you have said. You have interpreted life to me. You have given me a new conception of my God and Savior." Miss Clifford seemed quenched and humbled by these words. Her enthusiasm faded away, and she looked at Helen with a deprecatory air as she replied, "Don't say that. I never felt so unfit for anything but to sit at the feet of Christ's disciples and learn of them. Yet I, so many years one of these disciples, had been sitting at her feet and had learned of her. Never had I so realized the magnitude of the work to be done in this world, nor the power and goodness of Him who has undertaken to do it all. I was glad to be alone, to walk my room singing praises to Him for every instance in which, as my physician, He had disappointed my hope and defeated my joys, and given me to drink of the cup of sorrow and bereavement." May 24th. I read to Ernest the extract from Fenelon, which has made such an impression on me. "Every businessman, in short, every man leading an active life, ought to read that," he said. "We should have a new order of things as the result. Instead of fancying that our ordinary daily work was one thing, and our religion quite another thing, we should transmute our drudgery into acts of worship. Instead of going to prayer meetings to get into a good frame, we should live in a good frame from morning till night, from night till morning. And prayer and praise would only be another form for expressing the love and faith and obedience we had been exercising amid the pressure of business." "I only wish I had understood this years ago," I said. "I have made prayer too much of a luxury, and have often inwardly chafed and fretted when the care of my children at times made it utterly impossible to leave them for private devotions. When they had been sick, for instance, or in other like emergencies, I reasoned this way: here is a special demand on my patience, and I am naturally impatient, for I must have time to go away and entreat the Lord to equip me for this conflict. But I see now that the simple act of acceptance of the duty imposed, and the solace and support withdrawn, would have united me more fully to Christ than the highest enjoyment of His presence in prayer could."
"Yes, every act of obedience is an act of worship," he said.
"But why don't we learn that sooner? Why do we waste our lives before we learn how to live?"
"I am not sure," he returned, "that we do not learn as fast as we are willing to learn. God does not force instruction upon us, but when we say, as Luther did, 'More light, Lord, more light,' the light comes."
I questioned myself after he had gone as to whether this could be true of me. Is there not in my heart some secret reluctance to know the truth, lest that knowledge should call to a higher and holier life than I have yet lived? June 2nd. I went to see Mrs. Campbell a few days ago, and found, to my great joy, that Helen had just been there, and that they had an earnest conversation together. Mrs. Campbell failed a good deal of late, and it is not probable we should have her with us much longer. Her every look and word is precious to me when I think of her as one who is so soon to enter the unseen world and see our Savior and be welcomed home by Him. If it is so delightful to be with those who are on the way to heaven, what would it be like to have fellowship with one who had come thence and could tell us what it is? She spoke freely about death, and said Ernest had promised to take charge of her funeral and to see that she was buried by the side of her husband. "You see, my dear," she added with a smile, "though I am expecting to be so soon a saint in heaven, I am a human being still, with human weaknesses. What can it really matter where this weary old body is laid away when I have done with it and gone and left it forever? And yet I am leaving directions about its disposal." I said I was glad that she was still human, but that I did not think it a weakness to take thought for the abode in which her soul had dwelt so long. I saw that she was tired and was coming away, but she held me and would not let me go. "Yes, I am tired," she said, "but what of that? It is only a question of days now, and all my tired feelings will be over. Then I shall be as young and fresh as ever, and shall have strength to praise and to love God as I cannot do now. But before I go, I want once more to tell you how good He is, how blessed it is to suffer with Him, how infinitely happy He has made me in the very hottest heat of the furnace.
it will strengthen you in your trials to recall this my dying testimony. There is no wilderness so dreary but that His love can illuminate it, no desolation so desolate but that He can sweeten it. I know what I am saying. It is no delusion. I believe that the highest, purest happiness is known only to those who have learned Christ in sick rooms, in poverty, in racking suspense and anxiety, amid hardships, and at the open grave. Yes, the radiant face, worn by sickness and suffering, but radiant still, said in language yet more unspeakably impressive. To learn Christ, this is life. I came into the busy and noisy streets as one descending from the mount, and on reaching home found my darling Una very ill in Ernest's arms. She had fallen and injured her head. How I had prayed that God would temper the wind to this shorn lamb, and now she had had such a fall. We watched over her till far into the night, scarcely speaking to each other. But I know by the way in which Ernest held my hand clasped in his that her precious life was in danger. He consented at last to lie down, but Helen stayed with me. What a night it was! God only knows what the human heart can experience in a space of time that men call hours. I went all over the past history of the child, recalling all her sweet looks and words, and my own secret repining at the delicate health that cut her off from so many of the pleasures that belonged to her age. And the more I thought, the more I clung to her, on whom, frail as she is, I was beginning to lean, and whose influence in our home I could not think of losing without a shudder. Alas, my faith seemed for a time to flee, and I see just what a poor, weak human being is without it. But before daylight crept into my room, light from on high streamed into my heart, and I gave even this, my ewe lamb, away, as my freewill offering to God. Could I refuse Him my child, because she was the very apple of my eye? Nay, then, but let me give to Him not what I value least, but what I prize and delight in most. Could I not endure heartsickness for Him who had given His only Son for me? And just as I got to that sweet consent to suffer, He who had only lifted the rod to try my faith laid it down. My darling opened her eyes and looked at us intelligently and with her own loving smile. But I dared not snatch her and press her to my heart. For her sake, I must be outwardly calm, at least. June 6th. I am at home with my precious Una. All the rest have gone to church. She lies peacefully on the bed, sadly disfigured for the time, but Ernest says he apprehends no danger now, and we are a most happy, a most thankful household. The children have all been greatly moved by the events of the last few days, and hover about their sister with great sympathy and tenderness. Where she fell from, or how she fell, no one knows. She remembers nothing about it herself, and it will always remain a mystery. This is the second time that this beloved child has been returned to us after we had given her away to God. And, as the giving cost us tenfold more now than it did when she was a feeble baby, so we receive her as a fresh gift from our loving Father's hand with tenfold delight. Ah, we have no excuse for not giving ourselves entirely to Him. He has revealed Himself to us in so many sorrows and in so many joys, revealed Himself as He doth not unto the world. End of chapter 25. Recording by Teresa Downey. Chapter 26 of Stepping Heavenward. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Teresa Downey. Stepping Heavenward by Elizabeth Prentice. Chapter 26. May 13th. This has been a Sunday to be held in long remembrance. We were summoned early this morning to Mrs. Campbell, and have seen her joyful release from the fetters that have bound her so long. Her loss to me is irreparable, but I truly thank God that one more tired traveler had a sweet welcome home. I can minister no longer to her bodily wants, and listen to her counsels no more. But she has entered as an inspiration into my life, and through all eternity I shall bless God that He gave me that faithful praying friend. How little they know who languish in what seems useless sick rooms, or amid the restrictions of frail health, what work they do for Christ by the power of saintly living, and by even fragmentary prayers. Before her words fade out of my memory, I want to write down, from hasty notes made at the time, her answers to some of the last questions I asked her on earth. She had always enjoyed intervals of comparative ease, and it was in one of these that I asked her what she conceived to be the characteristics of an advanced state of grace. She replied, "I think that the mature Christian is always, at all times, and in all circumstances, what he was in his best moments in the progressive stages of his life. There were seasons, all along his course, when he loved God supremely, when he embraced the cross joyfully and penitently, when he held intimate communion with the Christ, and loved his neighbor as himself. But he was always in terror, lest under the force of temptation, all this should give place to deadness and dullness, when he should chafe and rebel in the hour of trial, and judge his fellow man with a harsh and bitter judgment, and give way to angry, passionate emotions. But these fluctuations cease after a time to disturb his peace. Love to Christ becomes the abiding, inmost principle of his life. He loves him rather for what he is than for what he has done or will do for him individually. And God's honor becomes so dear to him that he feels personally wounded when that is called in question. And the will of God becomes so dear to him that he loves it best when it triumphs at his cost. Once he only prayed at set times and seasons, and idolized good frames and fervent emotions. Now he prays without ceasing, and whether on the mount or down in the depths, depends wholly on his Savior. His old self-confidence has now given place to childlike humility that will not let him take a step alone, and the sweet peace that is now habitual to him, combined with the sense of his own imperfections, fills him with love to his fellow man. He hears and believes and hopes and endures all things, and thinketh no evil. The tones of his voice, the very expression of his countenance, become changed. Love, now controlling where human passions held sway. In short, he is not only a new creature in Jesus Christ, but the habitual and blessed consciousness that this is so." These words were spoken deliberately and with reflection. "You have described my mother, just as she was from the moment her only son, the last of six, was taken from her," I said at last. "I never quite understood how that final sorrow weaned her, so to say, from herself, and made her life all love to God and all love to man. But I see it now. Dear Mrs. Campbell, pray for me that I may yet wear her mantle." She smiled with a significance that said she had already done so. And then we parted that she might end her pilgrimage and go her rest, parted that I might pursue mine. I know not how long, nor amid how many cares and sorrows, nor with what weariness and heart-sickness, parted to meet again in the presence of Him we love, with those who have come out of great tribulation, whose robes have been made white in the blood of the Lamb, and who are before the throne of God and serve Him day and night in His temple, to hunger no more, neither thirst any more, for the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall lead them into living fountains of waters, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. May 25th. We were talking of Mrs. Campbell, and of her blessed life, and blessed death. Helen said it discouraged and troubled her to see and hear such things. "The last time I saw her, when she was able to converse," said she, "I told her that when I reflected on my want of submission to God's will, I doubted whether I really could be His child. She said, in her gentle, sweet way, "Would you venture to resist his will if you could? Would you really have your dear James back again in this world if you could?" "I would. I certainly would," I said. She returned, "I sometimes find it a help, when dull and cramped in my devotions, to say to myself, suppose Christ should now appear before you, and you could see him as he appeared to his disciples on earth. What would you say to him?" This brings him near, and I say what I would say if he were visibly present. I do the same when a new sorrow threatens me. I imagine my Redeemer as coming personally to say to me, "For your sake, I am a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Now for my sake, give me this child, bear this burden, submit to this loss." Can I refuse him? "Now, dear, he has really come thus to you, and asked you to show your love to him, your faith in him, by giving him the most precious of your treasures. If he were here at this moment, and offered to restore it to you, would you dare to say, 'Yea, Lord, I know far better than thou dost what's good for him and good for me. I will have him returned to me, cost what it may. In this world of uncertainties and disappointments, I shall be sure of happiness in his society, and he will enjoy more here on earth with me than he could enjoy in the companionship of saints and angels and of the Lord himself in heaven.' Could you dare say this?" Oh, Katie, what straits she drove me into! No, I could not dare say that. "Then, my darling little sister," I cried, "you will give up the struggle? You will let God do what he will with his own?" "I have to let him," she replied, "but I submit because I must." I looked at her gentle, pure face as she uttered these words, and could only marvel at the will that had no expression there. "Tell me," she said, "do you think a real Christian can feel as I do? For my part, I doubt it. I doubt everything." "Doubt everything, but believe in Christ," I said. "Suppose, for argument's sake, you are not a Christian. You can become one now." The color rose in her lovely face. She clasped her hands in a sort of ecstasy. "Yes," she said, "I can." At last, God had sent her the word she wanted. May 28th. Helen came to breakfast this morning in a simple white dress. I had not time to tell the children not to allude to it, so they began in chorus, "Why, Aunt Helen, you have put on a white dress! Why, Auntie, how queer you look! Hurrah, if she doesn't look like other folks!" She bore it all with her usual gentleness, or rather with a positive sweetness that captivated them as her negative patience had never done. I said nothing to her, nor did she to me till late in the day, when she came to me and said, "Katie, God taught you what to say. All these years I have been tormenting myself with doubts as to whether I could be his child, while so unable to say, 'Thy will be done.' If you had said, 'Why, yes, you must be his child, for you professed yourself one a long time ago, and ever since have lived like one,' I should have remained as wretched as ever. As it is, a mountain has been rolled off my heart. Yes, if I was not his child yesterday, I can become one today. If I did not love him then, I can begin now." I do not doubt that she was his child yesterday, and last year, and years ago. But let her think what she pleases. A new life is opening before her. I believe it is to be a life of entire devotion to God, and that out of her sorrow there shall spring up a wondrous joy. September 2nd, Sweet Briar Farm. Ernest spent Sunday with us, and I have just driven him to the station and seen him off. Things have prospered with us to such a degree that he has been extravagant enough to give me the use, for the summer, of a bonny little nag and an antiquated vehicle, and I have learned to drive. To be sure, I broke one of the shafts of the poor old thing the first time I ventured forth alone, and the other day nearly upset my cargo of children in a pond where I was silly enough to undertake to water my horse.
But Ernest, as usual, had patience with me, and begged me to spend as much time as possible in driving about with the children. It is a new experience, and I enjoy it quite as much as he hoped I should. Helen is not with us. She has spent the whole summer with Martha. For Martha, poor thing, is suffering terribly from rheumatism, and is almost entirely helpless. I am so sorry for her. After so many years of vigorous health, how hard it must be to endure this pain. With this drawback, we have had a delightful summer. Not one sick day, nor one sick night. With no baby to keep me awake, I sleep straight through, as Raymond says, and wake in the morning refreshed and cheerful. We shall have to go home soon. How cruel it seems to bring up children in a great city. Yet what can be done about it? Wherever there are men and women, there must be children. What a howling wilderness either city or country would be without them. The only drawback on my felicity is the separation from Ernest, which becomes more painful every year to us both. God has blessed our married life. It has had its waves and its billows, but thanks unto Him, it has at last settled down into a calm sea of untroubled peace. While I was secretly berating my dear husband for giving so much attention to his profession as to neglect me and my children, he was becoming every day more the ideal of a physician, cool, calm, thoughtful, studious, ready to sacrifice his life at any moment in the interests of humanity. How often I have mistaken his preoccupied air for indifference. How many times I have inwardly accused him of coldness when his whole heart and soul were filled with the grave problem of life, aye, and of death likewise. But we understand each other now, and I am sure that God dealt wisely and kindly with us when he brought together two such opposite natures. No man of my vehement nature could have borne with me as Ernest has done, and if he had married a woman as calm, as undemonstrative as himself, what a strange home his would have been for the nurture of little children. But the heart was in him, and only wanted to be waked up, and my life has called forth music from his. Ah, there are no partings and meetings now that leave discords in the remembrance, no neglected birthdays, no forgotten courtesies. It is beautiful to see the thoughtful brow relax in the presence of wife and children, and to know that ours is, at last, the happy home I so long sighed for. Is the change all in earnest? Is it not possible that I have grown more reasonable, less childish and aggravating? We are at a farmhouse. Everything is plain, but neat and nice. I asked Mrs. Brown, our hostess, the other day, if she did not envy me my four little pets. She smiled and said they were the best children she ever saw, and that it was well to have a family if you had means to start them in the world. For her part, she lived from hand to mouth, as it was, and was sure she could never stand the worry and care of a house full of young ones. But the worry and care is only half the story, I said. The other half is pure joy and delight. Perhaps so to people that are well-to-do, she replied. But to poor folks, driven to death as we are, it's another thing. I was telling him yesterday what a mercy that it was there weren't any young ones around under my feet, and I could take city boarders and help work off the mortgage on the farm. And what did your husband say to that? Well, he said we were young and hearty, and that there was no such tear and hurry about the mortgage, and that he'd give his right hand to have a couple of boys like yours. Well? Why, I said, supposing we had a couple of boys, they wouldn't be like yours, dressed to look genteel and to have their genteel ways, but a pair of wild colts, into everything, tearing their clothes off their backs, wasting faster than we could earn. He said it wasn't the clothes, 'twas the flesh and blood he wanted, and 'twasn't no use to argufy about it. A man that hadn't got any children, one more'n half a man. Well, says I, just supposing you had a pack of 'em, what have you got to give 'em? Just exactly what my father and mother gave me, says he. Two hands to earn their bread with, and a welcome you could have heard from Dan to Beersheba. I like to hear that, I said, and I hope many such welcomes will resound in this house. Suppose money does come in while little goes out. Suppose you get possession of the whole farm. What then? Who will enjoy it with you? Who will you leave it to when you die? And in your old age, who will care for you? You seem awful earnest, she said. Yes, I am in earnest.
I want to see little children adorning every home, as flowers adorn every meadow and every wayside. I want to see them welcomed to the homes they entered, to see their parents grow less and less selfish and more loving because they have come. I want to see God's precious gifts accepted, not frowned upon and refused. Mr. Brown came in, so I could say no more, but my heart warmed toward him as I looked at his frank, good-humored face, and I should have been glad to give him the right hand of friendship. As it was, I could only say a word or two about the beauty of his farm and the scenery of this whole region.
"Yes," he said, gratified that I appreciated his fields and groves. "It is a tormented, pretty land farm. Part of it was her father's, and part of it was my father's. There ain't another like it in the country. As to the scenery, I don't know as I've ever looked at it. City folks talk a good deal about it, but they've nothing to do but look round."
Walter came trotting in on two bare white feet, and with his shoes in his hand. He had had his nap, felt as bright and as fresh as he looked rosy, and I did not wonder at Mr. Brown's catching him up and clasping his sunburnt arms around the little fellow, impressing him against the warm heart that yearned for nestlings of its own. September 23rd. Home again, and full of the thousand cares that follow the summer and precede the winter. But let mothers and wives fret as they will. They enjoy these labors of love, and would feel lost without them. For what amount of leisure, ease, and comfort would I exchange husband and children and this busy home? Martha is better, and Helen has come back to us. I don't know how we have lived without her so long. Her life seems necessary to the completion of every one of ours. Some others have fancied it necessary to the completion of theirs, but she has not agreed with them. We are glad enough to keep her, and yet I hope the day will come when she, so worthy of it, will taste the sweet joys of wifehood and motherhood. January 1st, 1853. It is not always so easy to practice as it is to preach. I can see in my wisdom 40 reasons for having 4 children and no more. The comfort of sleeping in peace, of having a little time to read, and to keep on with my music, strength with which to look after Ernest's poor people when they are sick, and to tell the truth, strength to be bright and fresh and lovable to him. All these little joys have been growing very precious to me, and now I must give them up. I want to do it cheerfully, and without a frown, but I find I love to have my own way, and that at the very moment I was asking God to anoint my work for me, I was secretly marking it out for myself. It is mortifying to find my will less in harmony with his than I thought it was, and that I want to prescribe to him how I shall spend the time and the health and strength which are his, not mine. But I will not rest till this struggle is over, till I can say with a smile, not my will, but thine. We have been this winter one of the happiest families on earth. Our love to each other, Ernest's and mine, though not perfect, nothing on earth is, has grown less selfish and more Christ-like. It has been sanctified by prayer and by the sorrows we have borne together. Then the children have been well and happy, and the source of almost unmitigated joy and comfort. And Helen's presence in this home, her sisterly affection, her patience with the children, and her influence over them, is a benediction for which I cannot be thankful enough. How delightful it is to have a sister! I think it is not often the case that own sisters have such perfect Christian sympathy with each other as we have. Ever since the day she ceased to torment herself with the fear that she was not a child of God, and laid aside the somber garments she had worn so long, she's had a peace that has scarcely known a cloud. She says in a note written me about the time, "I want you to know, my darling sister, that the despondency that made my affliction so hard to bear fled before those words of you, which, as I have already told you, God taught you to speak. I do not know whether I was really his child at the time or not. I had certainly had an experience very different from yours. Prayers had never been much more to me than a duty, and I had never felt the sweetness of that harmony between God and I, the human soul, that I know can take away all the bitterness from the cup of sorrow. I knew, who can help knowing it that reads God's word, that he required submission from his children,
and that His children gave it, no matter what it cost. The Bible is full of beautiful expressions of it. So are our hymns. So are the written lives of all good men and good women. And I have seen it in you, my dear Katie, at the very moment when you were accusing yourself of the want of it. Entire oneness of the will with the divine will seemed to me to be the law and the gospel of the Christian life. In this evidence of a renewed nature, I found wanting in myself. At any moment during the 3 years following James's death, I would have snatched away from God if I could. I was miserably lonely and desolate without Him, not merely because He had been so much to me, but because His loss revealed to me the distance between Christ and my soul. All I could do was to go on praying, year after year, in a dreary, hopeless way, that I might learn to say, as David did, quote, "I opened not my mouth because thou didst it," unquote. When you suggested that instead of trying to figure out whether I had loved God, I should begin to love Him now, light broke in upon my soul. I gave myself to Him that instant, and as soon as I could get away by myself, I fell upon my knees and gave myself up to the sense of His sovereignty for the first time in my life. Then, too, I looked at my light affliction and at the weight of glory side by side and thanked Him that through the one He had revealed to me the other. Katie, I know the human heart is deceitful above all things, but I think it would be a dishonor to God to doubt that He then revealed Himself to me as He doth not to the world, and that the sweet peace I then found in yielding to Him will be more or less mine so long as I live. Oh, if all sufferers could learn what I have learned, that every broken heart could be healed as mine has been healed. My precious sister, cannot we make this one part of our mission on earth, to pray for every sorrow-stricken soul, and whenever we have influence over such, to lead it to honor God by instant obedience to His will, whatever that may be? I have dishonored Him by years of rebellious, carefully nursed sorrow. I want to honor Him now by years of resignation and grateful joy. Reading this letter over in my present mood has done me good. More beautiful faith in God than Helen's I have never seen. Let me have it, too. May this prayer, which under the inspiration of the moment I can offer without a misgiving, become the habitual, deep-seated desire of my soul. Quote, "Bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Take what I cannot give, my heart, body, thoughts, time, abilities, money, health, strength, nights, days, youth, age, and spend them in Thy service, O my crucified Master, Redeemer, God. O let these not be mere words. Whom have I in heaven but Thee? And there is none upon earth that I desire in comparison of Thee. My heart is athirst for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God?" Unquote. End of chapter 26. Recording by Teresa Downey. Chapter 27 of Stepping Heavenward. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Teresa Downey. Stepping Heavenward by Elizabeth Prentice. Chapter 27. August 1st. I have just written to Mrs. Brown to know whether she will take us for the rest of the summer. A certain little man, not a very old little man either, has kept us in town till now. Since he has come, we are all very glad of him, though he came on his own invitation, brought no wardrobe with him, does not pay for his board, never speaks a word, takes no notice of us, and wants more waiting on than anyone else in the house. The children are full of delicious curiosity about him, and overwhelm him with presents of the most heterogeneous nature. Sweetbriar Farm, August 9th. We got there this afternoon, bag and baggage. I had not said a word to Mrs. Brown about the addition to our family circle, knowing she had plenty of room, and as we alighted from the carriage, I snatched my baby from his nurse's arms and ran gaily up the walk with him in mine.
If this splendid fellow doesn't convert her, nothing will, I said to myself. At that instant, what should I see but Mrs. Brown running to meet me with a boy in her arms, exactly like Mr. Brown, only not quite 6 feet long and not sunburnt. "There," I cried, holding up my little old man. "There," said she, holding up hers. We laughed till we cried. She took my baby and I took hers. After looking at him, I liked mine better than ever. After looking at mine, she was perfectly satisfied with hers. We got into the house at last. That is to say, we mothers did. The children darted through it and out of the door that led to the fields and woods and vanished in the twinkling of an eye. Mrs. Brown had always been a pretty woman, with bright eyes, shining, well-kept hair, and a color in her cheeks like the rose which had given its name to her farm. But there was now a new beauty in her face. The mysterious and sacred sufferings and joys of maternity had given it thought and feeling. "I had no idea I should be so fond of a baby," she said, kissing it whenever she stopped to put in a comma. "But I don't know how I ever got along without one. He's off at work nearly the whole day, and when I had got through with mine and had put on my afternoon dress and was ready to sit down, you can't think how lonesome it was. But now, by the time I am dressed, baby is ready to go out and get the air. He knows the minute he sees me bring out his little hat that he's going to see his father, and he's awful fond of his father. Though that isn't so strange either, for his father's awful fond of him. All his little ways are so pretty, and he never cries unless he's hungry or tired. Tell mother a pretty story now. Yes, mother hears. Bless his little heart." Then when Mr. Brown came home to his supper, his face was a sight to see, as he caught sight of me at my open window and came to it with the child's white arms clinging to his neck, looking as happy and as bashful as a girl. "You see, she must needs go to quartering this bouncing young one on me," he said, "as if I didn't have to work hard enough before. Well, maybe he'll get his feet off the farm. We'll see what we can do."
"Mama," Una whispered as he went off with his facsimile to kiss it rapturously behind a woodpile, "do you think Mrs. Brown's baby very pretty?"
Which was so mild a way of suggesting the fact of the case that I kissed her without trying to hide my amusement. August 10th. After being cooped up in town so large a part of the summer, the children are nearly wild with delight at being in the country once more. Even our demure Una skips about with a buoyancy I have never seen in her. She never has her ill turns when out of the city, and I wish, for her sake, we could always live here. As to Raymond and Walter, I never pretend to see them except at their meals and their bedtime. They just live outdoors, following the men at their work, asking all sorts of absurd questions, which Mr. Brown reports to me every night with shouts of delighted laughter. Two gay and gladsome boys they are, really good without being priggish. I don't think I could stand that. People ask me how it happens that my children are all so promptly obedient and so happy. As if it chanced that some parents have such children, or chanced that some have not. I'm afraid it is only too true, as someone has remarked, that this is the age of obedient parents. What then will be the future of their children? How can they yield to God, who have never been taught to yield to human authority? And how well fitted will they be to rule their own households, who have never learned to rule themselves? August 31st. This has been one of those cold, dismal, rainy days, which are not infrequent during the month of August. So the children have been obliged to give up the open air of which they are so fond, and fall back upon what entertainment could be found within the house. I have read to them the little journal I kept during the whole life of the brother I'm not willing they should forget. His quaint and sagacious sayings were delicious to them. The history of his first steps, his first words, sounded to them like a fairy tale. And the story of his last steps, his last words on earth, had for them such a tender charm that there was a cry of disappointment from them all when I closed the little book and told them that we should have to wait till we got to heaven before we could know anything more about his precious life. How thankful I am that I kept this journal, and that I have almost as charming ones about most of my other children. What I speedily forgot amid the pressures of cares and of new events is safely written down, and will be the source of endless pleasure to them long after the hand that wrote
has ceased from its labors and lies inactive and at rest. Ah, it is a blessed thing to be a mother. September 1st. This baby of mine is certainly the sweetest and best I ever had. I feel an inexpressible tenderness for it, which I cannot quite explain to myself, for I have loved them all dearly, most dearly. Perhaps it is so with all mothers. Perhaps they all grow more loving, more forbearing, more patient as they grow older, and yearn over these helpless little ones with an ever-increasing, yet chastened delight. One cannot help sheltering their tender infancy, who will so soon pass forth to fight the battles of life, each one waging an invisible warfare against invisible foes. How thankfully we would fight it for them if we might. September 20th. The mornings and evenings are very cool now, while in the middle of the day it is quite hot. Ernest comes to see us very often, under the pretense that he can't trust me with so young a baby. He is so tender and thoughtful, and spoils me so, that this world is very bright to me. I am a little jealous of it. I don't want to be so happy in Ernest, or in my children, as to forget for one instant that I am a pilgrim and a stranger on earth. Evening. There is no danger that I shall. Ernest suddenly made his appearance tonight, and in a great burst of distress, quite unlike anything I ever saw in him, revealed to me that he had been feeling the greatest anxiety about me ever since the baby came. It is all nonsense. I cough, to be sure, but that is owing to the varying temperatures we always have at this season. I shall get over it as soon as we get home, I dare say. But suppose I should not, what then? Could I leave this precious little flock uncared for, untended? Have I faith to believe that if God calls me away from them, it will be in love to them? I do not know. The thought of getting away from the sin that still so easily besets me is very delightful, and I have enjoyed so many, many such foretastes of the bliss of heaven that I know I should be happy there. But then my children, all of them under 12 years old, I will not choose. I dare not. My married life has been a beautiful one. It is true that sin and folly and sickness and sorrow have marred its perfection, but it has been adorned by a love which has never faltered. My faults have never alienated Ernest. His faults, for like other human beings he has them, have never overcome my love to him. This has been the gift of God in answer to our constant prayer, that whatever other bereavement we might have to suffer, we might never be bereft of this benediction. It has been the glad secret of a happy marriage, and I wish I could teach it to every human being who enters upon a state that must bring with it the depth of misery or life's most sacred and mysterious joy. October 6th. Ernest has let me stay here to see the autumnal foliage and its ravishing beauty for the first, perhaps the last time. The woods and fields and groves are lighting up my very soul. It seems as if autumn had caught the inspiration and glow that summer had hidden in its floral beauty, its gorgeous sunsets, and its bow of promise in the heart of the hearts, was now flashing it forth upon the world with a lavish and opulent hand. I can hardly tear myself away and return to the prose of city life, but Ernest has come for us and is eager to get us home before colder weather. I laugh at his anxiety about his old wife. Why need he fancy that this trifling cough is not to give way, as it often has done before? Dear Ernest, I never knew that he loved me so. October 31st. Ernest's fear that he had let me stay too long in the country does not seem to be justified. We went so late that I wanted to indulge the children by staying late, so we have only just got home. I feel about as well as usual. It is true that I have a little soreness about the chest, but it does not signify anything. I never was so happy in my husband and children, in other words, in my home, as I am now. Life looks very attractive. I am glad that I am going to get well. But Ernest watches me carefully and wants me, as a precautionary measure, to give up music, writing, sewing, and painting, the very things that occupy me, and lead an idle, useless life for a time. I cannot refuse what he asks so tenderly, and as a personal favor to himself. Yet, I should like to fill the remaining pages of my journal. I never like to leave things incomplete. June 1st, 1858. I wrote that 7 years ago, little dreaming how long it would be before I should use a pen. 7 happy years ago. I suppose that some who have known what my outward life has been during this period would think of me as a mere object of pity. There has certainly been suffering and deprivation enough to justify the sympathy of my dear husband and children, and the large circle of friends who have rallied about us. How little we knew we had so many! God has dealt very tenderly with me. I was not stricken down by sudden disease, nor were the things I delighted in all taken away at once. There was a gradual loss of strength and gradual increase of suffering, and it was only by degrees that I was asked to give up the employments in which I delighted, my household duties, my visits to the sick and suffering, the society of beloved friends. Perhaps Ernest perceived and felt my deprivations sooner than I did. His sympathy always seems to outrun my disappointments. When I compare him, as he is now, with what he was when I first knew him, I bless God for all the precious lessons he has taught him at my cost. There is a tenacity and persistence about his love for me that has made these years almost as wearisome to him as they have been to me. As to myself, if I had been told what I was to learn through these protracted sufferings, I am afraid I should have shrunk back in terror, and so have lost all the sweet lessons God proposed to teach me. As it is, he has led me on, step by step, answering my prayers in his own way, and I cannot bear to have a single human being doubt that it has been a perfect way. I love and adore it just as it is. Perhaps the suspense has been one of the most trying features of my case. Just as I have unclasped my hand from my dear Ernest, just as I have let go my almost frantic hold of my darling children, just as heaven opened before me and I fancied my weariness over and my wanderings done, just then almost every alarming symptom would disappear and life recall me from the threshold of heaven itself. Thus I have been emptied from vessel to vessel, till I have learned that he is only truly happy who has no longer a choice of his own and lies passive in God's hand. Even now, no one can foretell the issue of this sickness. We live a day at a time, not knowing what shall be on the morrow. But whether I live or die, my happiness is secure, and so I believe is of my beloved ones. This is a true picture of our home. A sick room, full of the suffering, ravages the body but cannot touch the soul. A worn, wasting mother, ministered unto by a devoted husband and by unselfish Christian children, some of the peace of God, if not all of it, shines in every face, is heard in every tone. It is a home that typifies and foreshadows the home that is perfect and eternal. Our dear Helen has been given us for this emergency. It is not strange that seeing our domestic life should have awakened in her some yearnings for a home and a heart and children of her own. She has said that there was a weary point in her life when she made up her mind that she was never to know these joys, but she accepted her lot gracefully. I do not know any other word that describes so well the beautiful offering she made of her life to God and then to us. He accepted it and has given her all the cares and responsibilities of domestic life without the transcendent joys that sustain the wife and the mother. She has been all in all to our children, and God has been all in all to her. And she is happy in his service and in our love. June 20th. It took me nearly 2 weeks to write the above, at intervals as my strength allowed. Ernest has consented to my finishing this volume, of which so few pages yet remain. And he let me see a dear old friend who came all the way from my native town to see me, Dr. Eaton, our family physician as long as I could remember. He is of an advanced age, but full of vigor, his eye bright, and with a healthful glow on his cheek. But he says he is waiting and longing for his summons home. About that home we had a delightful talk together that did my very heart good. Then he made me tell him about this long sickness and the years of frail health and some of the sorrows through which I had toiled. "Ah, these lovely children are explained now," he said. "Do you really think," I asked, "that it has been good for my children to have a feeble, afflicted mother?" "Yes, I really think so. A disciplined mother, disciplined children." This comforting thought is one of the last drops in a cup of felicity already full. June 2nd. Another Sunday, and all at church except my darling Una, who keeps watch over her mother. These Sundays, when I have had them each alone in turn, have been blessed days to them and to me. Surely this is some compensation for what they lose in me of health and vigor. I know the state of each soul as far as it can be known, and have every reason to believe that my children all love my Savior and are trying to live for Him. I have learned at last not to despise the day of small things, to cherish the tenderest blossom, and to expect my dear ones to be imperfect before they become perfect Christians. Una is a sweet, composed young girl, now 18 years old, and what can I say more of the love her brothers bear her than this? They never tease her. She has long ceased asking why she must have delicate health when so many others of her age are full of animal life and vigor, but stands in her lot and place, doing what she can, suffering what she must, with a meekness that makes her lovely in my eyes, and that I am sure unites her closely to Christ. June 27th. It was Raymond's turn to stay with me today. He opened his heart to me more freely than he had ever done before. "Mama," he began, "if Papa is willing, I have made up my mind, that is to say, if I get decently good, to go on a mission." I said playfully, "And Mama's consent is not to be asked?" "No," he said, getting hold of what there is left of my hand. "I know you wouldn't say a word. Don't you remember telling me once, when I was a little boy, that I might go and welcome?" "And don't you remember," I returned, "that you cried for joy and then relieved your mind still farther by walking on your hands with your feet in the air?" We both laughed heartily at this remembrance, and then I said, "My dear boy, you know your father's plan for you?" "Yes, I know he expects me to study with him and take his place in the world. And it is a very important place." His countenance fell as he fancied I was not entering heartily into his wishes. "Dear Raymond," I went on, "I gave you to God long before you gave yourself to Him. If He can make you useful in your own or in other lands, I bless His name. Whether I live to see you as a man or not, I hope you will work in the Lord's vineyard wherever He calls. I never asked anything but usefulness in all my prayers for you, never once." His eyes filled with tears, he kissed me and walked away to the window to compose himself. My poor, dear, lovable, loving boy. He has all his mother's trials and struggles to contend with, but what matter it if they bring him the same peace? June 30th. Everybody wonders to see me once more interested in my long-closed journal, and becoming able to see the dear friends from whom I have been, in a measure, cut off. We cannot ask the meaning of this remarkable increase of strength. I have no wish to choose, but I have come to the last page of my journal, and living or dying shall write in this volume no more. It closes upon a life of much childishness and great sinfulness, whose record makes me blush with shame, but I no longer need to relieve my heart with seeking sympathy in its unconscious pages, nor do I believe it well to go on analyzing it as I have done. I have had large experience of both joy and sorrow. I have the nakedness and the emptiness, and I have seen the beauty and sweetness of life. What I say now, let me say to Jesus. What time and strength I used to spend in writing here, let me spend in praying for all men, for all sufferers who are out of the way, for all whom I love, and their name is Legion, for I love everybody. Yes, I love everybody. That crowning joy has come to me at last. Christ is in my soul. He is mine. I am as conscious of it as that my husband and children are mine, and His Spirit flows from mine in the calm peace of a river whose banks are green with grass and glad with flowers. If I die, it will be to leave a wearied and worn body and a sinful soul to go joyfully to be with Christ, to weary and to sin no more. If I live, I shall find much blessed work to do for Him. So, living or dying, I shall be the Lord's. But I wish, oh, how earnestly, that whether I go or stay, I could inspire some lives with the joy that is now mine.
For many years I have been rich in faith, rich in an unfaltering confidence that I was beloved of my God and Savior. But something was wanting. I was ever groping for a mysterious grace, the want of which made me often sorrowful in the midst of my most sacred joy, imperfect when I most longed for perfection. It was that personal love to Christ of which my precious mother so often spoke to me, which she often urged me to seek upon my knees. If I had known then, as I know now, what this priceless treasure could be to a sinful human soul, I would have sold all that I had to buy the field wherein it lay hidden. But not till I was shut up to prayer and to the study of God's Word, by the loss of earthly joys, sickness destroying the flavor of them all, did I begin to penetrate the mystery that is learned under the cross. And wondrous as it is, how simple is this mystery! To love Christ, and to know that I love Him, this is all. And when I entered upon the sacred, yet oft-times homely duties of married life, if this love had been mine, how would that life have been transfigured? The petty faults of my husband, under which I chafed, would not have moved me. I should have welcomed Martha and her father to my home, and made them happy there. I should have had no conflicts with my servants, shown no petulance to my children, for it would not have been I who spoke and acted, but Christ who lived in me. Alas, I have had less than 7 years in which to atone for a sinful, wasted past, and to live a new and a Christ-like life. If I am to have yet more, thanks be to Him who has given me the victory, that life will be love, not the love that rests in the contemplation and adoration of its object, but the love that gladdens, sweetens, solaces other lives. O gift of gifts, O grace of faith, my God, how can it be that Thou who hast discerning love should give that gift to me? How many hearts Thou mightst have had, more innocent than mine, how many souls more worthy far of that sweet touch of Thine. O grace, into unlikeliest hearts it is Thy boast to come, the glory of Thy light to find in darkest spots a home. O happy, happy that I am, if Thou canst be, O faith, the treasure that Thou art in life, what will Thou be in death? Stepping Westward. Quote, while my fellow traveler and I were walking by the side of Loch Katrine one fine evening after sunset, in our road to a hut where in the course of our tour we had been hospitably entertained some weeks before, we met, in one of the loneliest parts of that solitary region, two well-dressed women, one of whom said to us, by way of greeting, "What? You are stepping westward? What? You are stepping westward? Yea, 'twould be a wildish destiny, if we who thus together roam in a strange land and far from home, were in this place the guests of chance. Yet who would stop or fear to advance, though home or shelter he had none, with such a sky to lead him on? The dewy ground was dark and cold, behind all gloomy to behold, and stepping westward seemed to be a kind of heavenly destiny. I liked the greeting. 'Twas a sound of something without place and bound, and seemed to give me spiritual right to travel through that region bright. The voice was soft, and she who spake was walking by her native lake. The salutation had to me the very sound of courtesy. Its power was felt, and while my eye was fixed upon the glowing sky, the echo of the voice inwrought a human sweetness with the thought of traveling through the world that lay before me in my endless way." Unquote. Wordsworth. End of chapter 27. End of Stepping Heavenward by Elizabeth Prentice. Recording by Teresa Downing. In honor of her friend, Tammy Martin, who first introduced her to Stepping Heavenward.
Hey.
Hey, Pennsylvania, looking to amp up how you can enjoy your sports? Then register with BetMGM to get instant access to a fun variety of parlay selection features, like the new look same game parlay, live betting options, and more. Don't miss out on any of the hard-hitting action at BetMGM, the sportsbook born in Vegas. New customers can receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. Plus, when you huddle up with BetMGM at your fingertips, every pass, every catch, and every game matter more than ever. Don't miss out on any of the hard-hitting action. Place your money line and parlay bets with BetMGM today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. Pennsylvania only. New customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem, help is available. Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan, additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.